Hello and welcome to the latest episode of Master of None podcast. I am your host, Stephen Murphy. I have two guests, my usual guests tonight, Sam and Westy. Introduce yourselves.
Hey, how's it going?
Hi, I'm Westy. I like long walks on the beach and Canada dinners.
Looking for friendship and possibly more.
Just to put this show into context, we're doing this on the internet, so if...
Sam, are you 94 years old on the internet?
We're doing this on the interwebs.
On the Facebook. We'll do this
on the line. Facebook. Put it out there, on the line.
Yeah, on the line, yeah. No, we're doing this over Zoom because of the pandemic and whatnot. And Sam thinks that me and Westy are dirty and he won't listen to his house anymore. Yeah. True or false? Yeah, true or false,
social
Sam?
Distancing. Social distancing.
Yeah, you're bigger
than doing our part, you know?
Yeah. We're not saying we're heroes, but, you know. We're also not saying that.
You do wear a cape.
You do wear a cape. So last night, myself and the boys decided to join again on a conference call and watch the 2003 Rugby World Cup final between England and Australia. Relive that game because, I don't know about you lads, but I remember watching it vaguely. I was only 9 at the time, but re-watching it last night, I didn't realise, you know, a lot of the stuff that actually happened. Westy, what age were you in 2003?
35.
35. Oh, no, younger than I thought.
12.
Yeah, I was 13 watching this game. I remember it really well, like, because I remember it was kind of just after I'd started. It was the year after I'd started in secondary school. So I was getting big into rugby at the time. I hadn't been as big a fan or follower of rugby, but I was playing it now. So it was the first year of playing rugby, and then for a World Cup to be in and for a team like England, who were, you know, it wasn't like a New Zealand, Australia or New Zealand, South Africa final. It was England were involved. So there was a lot of kind of players you'd know or you'd know from the Six Nations and stuff. So that was quite big. I remember enjoying it a lot more then than I did yesterday. It was actually quite a scrappy game, which I'd completely forgotten about.
Yeah, we noticed this yesterday. I think it was quite humid conditions and the ball was slippery, but there was an awful lot of handling errors. As you say, it was just a sloppy kind of game to watch. And when you look at the teams, I forgot just how many fucking powerhouses England had back in that team. You know, Delalio, you know, you got Matt Dawson, Johnny Wilkinson, Mike Tindall.
Fullback, Ben Kay.
Yeah.
Josh Lucy, fullback. Like, you know, Mike Catt was on the bench.
Yeah, Mike Catt appeared. That was amazing.
Yeah.
But yeah, a sloppy game. And one thing we noticed, stat attack, should I say. How many lineouts was stolen? There was at least between
nine
the two teams.
Nine by about half time, I think, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was at least low teens of when it came to lineouts being stolen, which was incredible. And England always went to the back at the lineout.
Yeah, England continuously went for the back. So there was a game plan there that just didn't seem to be working for them. They were going for the back constantly, and it wasn't working. They were overthrowing it or not going to hand repeatedly and then still going to the back of the line out. It just wasn't working out for them. But you have to think that, like, if they were going for the back as much as they were in those conditions and it wasn't working, the reason they were sticking to it is because they definitely were supposed to be doing something off the back of those lineouts that was to focus in. Like, that was definitely a game plan. Otherwise, you know, you set your stall and you'd set your maul and you'd go for it. But if they're playing into the back as much as they were, I think it means that they wanted to try and attack that Australian 10 or something. It wasn't happening because they weren't getting the ball at all. But if they were going to continuously do something that's not working like that, it was for a reason.
Yeah, it was definitely. And a lot of the times it looked like when the ball went out to Wilkinson, it looked like this anyway. It could have been just on the day, but it necessarily wasn't a strict game plan. It was a lot of times lads took the ball out of standing still. Or we've seen a lot of ghost passes where they try and offload backwards and there's no one there. There was a couple of incredible offloads that never happened.
Offloads to no space at all. To complete space, nobody standing there.
Space is always dangerous, Westy. He's always dangerous.
But it is funny, you know, even, like, okay, we struggle to kind of discern a game plan from it, but you still see a similar style of play from the English happening. Like, They were very aggressive off the line. They did come up and kind of stop Australia from playing too much with the ball, forcing a lot of those errors. I mean, I think there was, if you think about the scrums, I think there was like 12 English scrums. I mean, it's not the exact same, but it's a very similar game plan that you see them play now. It is, they had that world-class pack back then that they kind of probably have again now, and that is kind of does dictate their play a lot. As much as Wilkinson is controlling the ball and controlling the game, the aggression and speed of their pack, I think, really defines how they play.
I think Wilkinson controlled a lot more of the games in the earlier games in that World Cup. I think that final in particular was kind of dictated by how scrappy it was. Centres were quite good. I thought that Greenwood and Tindall ran very well and kicked very well as Wilkinson. And then, like you said, the world-class pack, the Martin Johnson, Neil Back, Lawrence Dallaglio, they were just unbelievable ball carriers. They were so strong. And it's quite ironic that you say like that it's the similar style of play that they still utilise, because Eddie Jones was the Australian coach that day, and now he's the English coach. So is it maybe... I know, listening to an interview with Andy Friend recently, who was on the coaching ticket for that game, they were saying they were stifled by England's aggression and the speed in which they got up to it. But I wonder, was that a lesson learned for Eddie at the time? And did he bring that into the way? Or has he just been blessed with the fact that when he's the England coach, England have just continuously reeled off like a conveyor belt of world-class forwards that kind of back rows and locks are just such strong ball carriers, and they've had that since 2003.
Yeah, no, definitely. And as well, we noticed a lot of times it wasn't always Wilkinson playmaking. Sometimes Robinson would come in and, you know, he would dish the ball out. Sometimes you'd see Mike Tindall and Greenwood. They would, you know, it wasn't just heavily relying on Wilkinson to make the decisions and, you know, be the playmaker. Also, great to see Mike Tindall's nose in a straight line. That was always good to see. I don't know when he actually broke it, but definitely looks a lot different back then. Larkham, obviously, is the 10 for Australia in this game. But Elton Flatley, which is a great name, he did all the kicking. And we were kind of torn on him because, obviously, he kicked some great penalties in the last few minutes to equalise and whatnot. But he also missed... what did he miss? 3 out of his first 5?
Yeah, I think he had 1 out of 4 anyway, I think, at halftime. He had 25% success.
Yeah. Like, we said as Wesley last night, Australia could have won this game very easily.
Yeah. It's not like, you know, you always say that about games, right? Like, oh, there are points left on the pitch. And some of those kicks were challenging enough. But, I mean, some of them were bread and butter enough, you know, just slightly to the left or right of the post. Okay, a bit of distance. But yeah, he definitely felt like that is somewhere that let Australia down.
I don't remember him like as a player too much, Stephen Larkham, like an out half, as a kicking out half. But it really bemused me is the fact that if you go with your 12 as a kicker, and that's fine, yeah, and he kicks, that's grand. I don't care about your out half having to be your kicker or any of that sort of stuff. But the fact that he missed, you know, he got 1 of his first 4. And that Larkham never stepped up or took any kicks. I think that's quite like interesting, just to note that they just persevered with Flatley. Like, either they really didn't want to destroy his mentality and destroy his confidence, or he was just that good a kicker compared to Larkham that they didn't think that even if he's missed 3, he's going to come good in the end. Like, which he did. But
yeah, in fairness to him, you got to give him credit. Like, he after that poor start, he did kick some solid penalties at the end. You know, with the pressure on.
Yeah, and that's kind of that rings true for Wilkinson as well with his shocking drop kicks.
I was just going to go into that segment. So I was going to ask you, what was the biggest surprise to you from rewatching that game? And mine was that Wilkinson missed 3 drop goals before he kicked his winning drop goal.
Yeah, that'd be up
there. None of them were close. They were all a mile off.
And all on his good foot, and he nails one on his bad foot.
Yeah, Wilkinson, yeah, that was the biggest shock to me. Did anyone else shock you guys when you actually rewatched it last night?
Well, the biggest shock for me watching it was how scrappy the game was, because I remember watching it as a 13-year-old and I don't remember it being that scrappy. I remember being, because you know when you give me a slagging for it, and I'm a bit of an England fan, and I remember being quite happy with the win. And I remember being happy with the win and like coming out of it being like, oh, that's great. I've seen a team that I was supporting at the time. Like, I was obviously an Irish fan going into the World Cup, but when Ireland got knocked out, England would always be my second choice. And I remember being quite happy with them winning it, but I don't remember being that scrappy a game. Like, that completely slipped my mind from when I rewatch it now, whatever it is. So that was 2003, so it's what, 17 years later. I did not remember it being that scrappy a game.
What about you, Westy?
I think I said it when we were watching it. I don't know if it's really shocking about the game, but watching Stephen Larkin play and watching him have that kind of that probing kick in behind, it really was kind of one of the driving forces that gave Australia the momentum to kind of come back into the game. I think that definitely, you know, we can definitely see that in his coaching style, and that's what they're kind of trying to bring into Munster. So to kind of, you know, Munster trying to move away from that heavy pack mentality and kind of play a bit more of expansive rugby like most of the provinces are. But yeah, it was definitely, I thought that was an interesting thing because, again, I wouldn't have had great memory of Larkham as a player. I would have like remembered seeing him, but I wouldn't have, you know, I wouldn't have been able to say what kind of style he was going to have. But it definitely, and again, obviously, you know, his coach is not exactly like that. It's obviously going to be a bit different. He had it's a long time between then and now, but it's just interesting to see those similarities pop back up again. I think that's what they're trying to do with Joey Carberry at Munster. Get him to play, to be that probe in 10.
Yeah, it was smart by him because England were, you know, coming off the line quickly like they still do nowadays. And it's smart because it totally, you know, opens up space for them. Like when you look at Ireland, when they played England this year in Six Nations, that little grubber tree would have been very useful for them. So it was smart by Larkham.
And it was like when Ireland played England in the Six Nations, that damaged Ireland because Ireland were trying to defend quite strong and quite quick the way England would traditionally defend and defended in this game as well in the 2003 World Cup final. And two chips through caught Ireland completely off guard. So it's something that I think, you know, lots of teams like Connacht find it very difficult. And I'd say it's a new record, 10 minutes without me mentioning Connacht. But Connacht find it difficult to play against quick defences. It's like Edinburgh nullified us this year, and all last year you were watching Connacht struggle against a blitz defence. And then Carty has the ability to kick in behind, and when he does, that's when we start to open up the game. So I think that's something that, you know, Larkham's doing down in Munster, and Carty can start doing a bit more with Connacht, just getting in behind and just nullifying those blitz defences.
Yeah, definitely. Like when Ireland played England, they never seemed to cross the minds to do that, so that was a bit disappointing. But let's not talk about Ireland and England.
Before you move on, Smurf, just I was not like it wasn't shocking, like I didn't really notice it at all watching the game, but since reading about it just there today, doing a bit of kind of prep for this show, is it's just really interesting to see how the systems that they played back then. So this is 17 years ago. In terms of using your subs, because now you don't go through a game of rugby at whatever level it is, at like junior level, at, you know, pro 14 level, at international level, without pretty much unloading the entire bench. But you look at England here, they had one sub before the 80-minute mark, and that was Mike Catt in the 79th minute. And then they had a sub on the 85th, 86th, and the 93rd, and three unused subs, one of which was a front row, another which was a lock, and another which was scrum half. Like, that's just unheard of in rugby today. Like, you unload the entire front row after 60 minutes, pretty much, in every game, even earlier sometimes. And your scrum half usually comes off around 70. You pretty much unload the entire bench in every game these days. And, like, both teams didn't use too many subs. Australia had one of 48, then 57, 57, 71, and then 92. Like, so they weren't unloading the entire bench at all.
Well, do you think that's just is that just a one-off like thing that happened, or do you think that nowadays it's more physical? Is it faster pace? Is it?
I think the attitude to bench has changed over the last few years. You know, like I don't think it's a one-off. I think that was the way back then. You didn't replace your entire front row in one go at 60 minutes. You know, or after they've run. I think a lot of times now it's based on how far they've run. So after someone's run, I don't know, 500 meters. I don't know exactly how much it is. That's when they start looking at bringing them off. You know, they all wear the geo trackers now in the backs.
Yeah,
that's what I'm getting at. I just think it's a different attitude towards the players back then. I think you had your best 15 and you wanted your best 15 on the pitch for as long as possible. Whereas now it's more of a squad game. And like Eddie Jones alluded to it in the World Cup when he was dropped forward, put him on the bench for the semi-final. Like he just said, he's not dropped. It's just, this is the game plan. He's going to come off the bench. He's on the bench for this game, or he'll play his part. I think that now it's more of a kind of a full 23 instead, 23 worth of contributions instead of your starting 15 and one or and two.
Yeah, I know. I think France this year, when they were announcing teams, they wouldn't use substitutes or benches they called them finishers instead of calling on the bench. So I think, yeah, maybe back then it was sort of a sign of weakness if you kind of came off in the 68 minutes if you were front row. I think, yeah, I think the attitude definitely has changed towards that, which is for the better. But then you can also get on the other side, like what you're saying there, Westy, like, oh, someone ran so many meters, they need to come off. Like, that's, is that a bit too far?
Well, I think that that's the science side of it. I think your sports scientists kind of, they've done so much work on each player that they know how much a player can average per game to be at maximum potential for the entire season or for the majority of the season or whatever it is. I think that it's something like you were talking, actually, it was really interesting. You spoke to Kieran O'Sullivan about the Irish international American football team. And this is something he suggested had been around in American football since the 1950s, and we're only starting to use now, is in-game technology and the use of technology and statistics and video during the game. And that's something that rugby is doing now, but has been in American football for years. Like, your metrics were measured constantly in American football. You'd come out, having done two sprints in a row, you'd come out to rest so you could do another sprint. And that's kind of the way that rugby's going. Like, your front row is maxing out by 60. They're incapable of going on because they put in 60, they put in 80 minutes worth of work into 60 minutes. It's all scientifically done now.
Yeah, that's fair. One thing I noticed as well is, I was saying to you as well, the forward skill set compared to, you know, back then compared to now is obviously a lot different. Although I have to say, Delalio looked like, you know, you could pick him out and put him into a game nowadays and he'd be, you know, still the ideal number eight. For Robinson's try, you know, he does a burst of speed, beats a defender and offloads, you know, before he's been tackled. And it's like, it's just fantastic to see that. Like, he was amazing.
Yeah, I think I said it yesterday. I think that's kind of, I don't know, I remember kind of Lawrence Dalio was the first modern number eight. And again, there's probably other players who did the same thing, but he always stuck in my mind as that. I often forget how old he is because I think of him as playing more recent, because it is that style of play. He is a bit more of a ball handler, bit more of a skillful forward than, you know, that we were saying that, like, the forwards were more limited in terms of what they took on maybe in that game. Not necessarily they're not able for it, but
they're not being coached back then, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, that could have been, I mean, I think that's part of the England game plan, though, as well. They wanted to use their heavy pack to hit, and then let Wilkinson kick their points, you know? I mean, you don't just start taking, you don't just take three shots of the drop goal for the crack. Like, the plan was to kick your way ahead there, clearly.
Well, it worked.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think, like you're saying, Lawrence Dalalio was kind of them, like, I remember fondly as a kid watching Phil Vickery, Martin Johnson, Neil Back, like, these were good players, but I think they're players of their time. Like, Martin Johnson was an unbelievable captain, a great rugby player, but I don't think he'd find bridging the gap. If you were to put him, like, a peak Martin Johnson into international rugby now, I think he wouldn't find it as easy as Lawrence Dalalio. Like, Lawrence Dalalio is the one there that would bridge the gap, would play, like Westy said, as a modern number eight. Johnson was a heavy hitter, all guns blazing, you know, tough man rugby player, and that's kind of what he did. Like, obviously he had skills, but nothing compared to some of the second rows now, like some of the big round the corner ball playing second rows. I don't think he bridged that gap very well compared to the likes of Lawrence Dalalio.
It's unfair as well, because, you know, if he was playing now or he was starting to play rugby now, he would have been coached so differently. You know what I mean? And the way teams play rugby now, especially with the forwards, is not what it was back in 2003. You know, so maybe he would have been able to adjust and whatnot, but definitely.
Oh yeah, no. If he came through with training, obviously, but I'm just talking about that player at that time, lifting him out and putting him into an international setup. Now, it's a completely different sport. Like, it's the mentalities, the skill sets, the physicality, the what you do is completely different. But I don't think he would be able to be lifted right out of that situation there, 2003 World Cup, and put into an international team now. Whereas I think Lawrence Dalalio would be able to be lifted out and put into any starting Six Nations team and would be do fine.
Like, I agree with that. He looked very silky, and like his hands and whatnot, they were, you know, really impressive.
Let's remember as well, like, these guys, they'd only been professional for 8 years, you know, so a lot of them had come through. No, especially that pack, because that pack, I mean, it had a pretty high average age. So they would have spent the majority of their career not playing professional rugby, you know?
Yeah, true.
That obviously affects things like your conditioning and, you know, the skillfulness, I suppose, if you want to use that word.
I do want to use that word.
Yeah. I just, you know, you're throwing a lot of shade here saying that they're not skillful. I'm kind of like, well, let's see you do it, Smurf. How many World Cups did you win?
Two, actually. So, back in your box. No, I'm not throwing shade. I'm just making
those trophies points. I made you for Christmas don't count.
The go-karting one that I won when I was 15. As you know, those really cheap ones you can get for €5 or whatever store they can get them at. Who stood out as your player of the game sort of thing, or who stood out as having a really good game for both teams?
I mean, Johnny Wilkinson is the obvious one.
He did, but he also, like, the three missed drop goals, and he had a few loose kicks from play. Like, when you hear that game and you think back of it, you think that he was flawless and he was, you know, amazing, but he definitely kicked well from the tee and whatnot, but there was still a few, you know, loose kicks in there as well.
Yeah, I wouldn't put Wilkinson as having his best game. Like, Wilkinson was an unbelievable player. I think, in my opinion, the best out half I've seen. Like, you know, obviously the players from those 1970s Lions tours and stuff, but the best out half that I've watched since I started watching rugby, I think, was Wilkinson. But I don't
think he had his best game.
Better
than Dan Carter.
Oof, it's very close between the two of them. If Carter maybe just edges it, and then Wilkinson close second. But I think those two were special players.
Jack Carty, like,
Jack Carty. Jack Carty isn't—he's not really an out half. He's more like a higher being that plays in the out half role.
He's a deity or a deity.
Yeah, so it's unfair to compare mere mortals to Jack, but.
True. Good point. Thanks for calling me on that, Sam. I appreciate it.
But no, I do think that. Of the English players that played well, Robinson had a good game, and Greenwood and Tindall both had great games, and Lawrence Dallaglio was brilliant. And then from Australian point of view, I thought that they, as a whole, played okay. They didn't really do much, but I thought Greig and Lota Takiri were noticeable. I thought Greegan runs the game very well, and Lota Takiri is just an absolute monster, and his try early on is phenomenal. Like, to take that ball out of the air, it's up in the air for about 20 seconds.
It's a funny one because with the nature of that try, the cross field kick, and obviously, as I say, a great take from the air, great holding on to the ball, you know, to get over the line. You almost think like that's a real tone setting try. Like, that's a real kind of, like, there's acres of space there. Australia find it and they're in on top of it. Is it Jason Robinson tries to tackle him before he gets over the line?
It's a mismatch in height for sure.
And it's funny to me that Australia just couldn't build on that, you know, like, after having such a great run early on. You know, if that was a game on now live, you'd be like, oh, geez, where are they going to go from here? This is brilliant.
I think people probably forget that as well when they think back to the game that Australia scored first. I think that's, and they got the penalty, and it was, whatever, 30 metres out maybe from the post. And they declined to kick it and went for a scrum. I think then a few plays later, that's when the try comes from it. So, again, their mindset was quite aggressive then early on.
Yeah, and if you look at the team that they picked as well, though, like, they have Lota Takiri and Wendell Saylor on both wings and Sterling Mortlock in the centre. Like, they're going for a physically dominating back line in that. Like, with those players, they want to run, and they want to run hard. And I just don't think England gave them the opportunity. I think that try came for Lota Takiri. And they didn't capitalize and start using those strengths. Like, Wendell Saylor was pretty much anonymous. Like, we said it before we watched the game. Oh, he's playing Wendell Saylor. He's a beast. Like, you know, and then when he got subbed off, I went, Jesus Christ, I haven't heard his name once.
Like, yeah, I actually thought the exact same thing when I seen him coming off. I was like, God, he didn't really do much.
Yeah, I saw, like, because we saw Takiri getting involved and running in and cutting in and making lines. Wendell Saylor didn't do anything. Like, I think their game plan was probably to be aggressive and be strong, and it just didn't happen for them, really. And then England probably stopped it happening by being aggressive. Like, Greenwood puts in some huge tackles. Tindall plays some big tackles. And England just kept hold of the ball quite a lot as well. They might not have had good possession, but they had a lot of possession.
It was a very physical game. You know, there's some big hits going in.
Yeah, so you look at that kind of that back line, you know, like, Wilkinson, Tindall, Greenwood, like, again, as Sam said, like the two centers had great games, both quite physical, both quite exciting with the ball. I think Greenwood had one pretty bad knock on towards the end, didn't he? But the work rate is what strikes me from Tindall and Greenwood. Like, they were fired up for it, really. And I think that helps. It all feeds into itself, you know. The pack is dominating and mainly going forward. You've got Wilkinson, the genius that he is, pulling the strings, and then when you get that kind of work rate from the wing, and as well Jason Robinson as well. Yeah, it's just there's a lot of highlights on the England side, I think.
Yeah, underrated probably move of the game is Dawson's fake and go to set up the, you know, a few plays before the drop kick. It was massive. It totally caught Australia off guard, and he made, you know, 15, 20 yards.
Yeah, that's another one.
I forget how good Dawson was a scrum half, because again, I only kind of remember that I remember more vividly the latter years of his career. We came on in Six Nations and stuff, but yeah, Dawson was always looking for areas to snipe. You know, working really well with Wilkinson.
But again, as you say, it's easy to, when your pack is so, you know, not dominant. When your pack's so physical and they're making ground, it's, you know, easier.
Yeah, with that moment that you talked about there, Smurf, I remember reading Wilkinson's book when I was younger, and he talked about that moment, just how they were always lining up for the drop goal anyway. But when Dawson made that break, it gave them not just the extra 10 yards or whatever it was that he got, but it also meant that the entire Australian pack was now moving back instead of standing static, ready to defend and ready to get onto him. So it ends up putting them, Australia, under huge amounts of pressure, because they have to get around and readjust and resort themselves. So it was pivotal, like, it was absolutely huge. And, you know, obviously you don't know, but the way he was kicking at the time, Wilkinson to take that kick from 10 yards further out, it might not have gone the way it did. So it was massive.
Yeah, you have to, like, the balls on him, he's missed three already, and to go then with the World Cup final on the line of your weaker foot, I don't want to say weak foot because it's obviously not weak, but your weaker foot, it was just incredible. At 24 years old as well.
Yeah, it was huge.
Absolutely. I think, lads, we'll wrap it up soon, because I just want this to be a quick one, just because it's obviously there's no live sports to comment on, but I think we'll finish it with that. Do you think the correct team won?
Yeah, I think England had the smarter game plan on the day. They definitely played to their strengths a bit better. You know, there was a few decent performances. Justin Harrison played well for Australia. And a few other, you know, obviously Grogan had a great game. But I just think, I don't think it was cohesive at all for Australia. I think that's mainly down to the kind of, as we said, the fluidity and the dominance of the English pack. So, yeah, I think as much as it pains me to say it, and as much as none of them have ever shut up about it since, England deserved that World Cup.
We're talking about you, Sam, yeah. But just in case you're wondering.
Yeah. No, I think on the day, the teams were quite evenly matched. England probably should have taken advantage of the missed opportunities Australia had and gotten further ahead and not gone to the extra time. You know, Australia did well to get back into it, having missed the opportunities to go ahead. But on the whole, as the World Cup went, it was England's World Cup the whole way through. Australia did well and they went through it. But I remember thinking England were unbeatable at the time. Just Wilkinson just made them almost unbeatable, because no matter how many tries you scored, Wilkinson was getting two or three penalties. And that's what they did for that entire World Cup. They just kicked their way to it. And if you have a player with that kicking ability and those stats, like, why not?
Yeah, I think so too. I think England deserves it. Narrowly enough, but I think they still deserve it. Yeah, I just from watching the game, I remember, you know, I remember seeing a lot more from England than Australia. I think you're right, Westy. The cohesion just wasn't there for Australia, which also kind of helped the whole scrappy game and the nature of it. But yeah, it pains me to say it too. They actually, no, feck it. Australia deserved to win. Feck England.
We're back. Give it back to them. Let's recall it.
Yeah, I'm recalling it. The Australia won.
Do you want to give Eddie Jones the World Cup, though? Do you want to give Eddie Jones another World Cup?
Oh, man.
He only has part of a World Cup with South Africa.
Yeah, it's still more than...
One of the things I thought was weird, the drop goal for the winner, it's like 30 seconds or a minute before the end of the... 2 minutes before the end of the game.
It's 35 seconds to go.
Why don't you hold on to it?
Yeah, you could hold on to it, but if Dawson makes the break he does and puts you in the position to go for it, it might be the best opportunity you're going to get. Like, if they're planning for Wilkinson kicking from all sorts of positions all the way through training, they probably have in their mind your ideal scenarios. And being that close in front of the post with Australia moving backwards, it was probably just the right time to go for it. Wilkinson was probably feeling at his most confidence because the Australian pack were too busy trying to get back on side and trying to get back into a position. instead of setting themselves. So I think that if they had been barging up the way they were and Dawson hadn't made the break and was just forwards, 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 they probably would have held on to it until well past the 80. But the fact he makes that break gets them in such a position, such a position of dominance. Just go for it.
Yeah, you don't want to, you don't want to risk losing ground then again. Yeah, I think yeah, the where they were, I think it was the right decision to go for it then. But I think when we said about last night, it was a tad bit anticlimactic. Do you know what I mean? Because there's 2 minutes left, but Australia don't really get a sniff of it. It's a bit disappointing.
Yeah, but yeah, it's our boy Mike Catt who gets to kick it out to finish. So everyone wins.
I suppose when we think of drop goals to win, and you romanticize thinking back to this World Cup final and, you know, Johnny Wilkinson orchestrating things and having that drop goal. The most recent drop goal and, well, of that nature in our memories is probably Johnny Sexton against France 2 years ago.
Yeah, and that was a think proper of it as the buzzer last, beater.
Yeah, or there's O'Gara in the for the grandstand. Oh, you know, like,
or the Munster one.
That wasn't the last play of the game either, was it?
No, that wasn't. Remember the one against, was it against Northampton maybe? I'm not sure, but for Munster, O'Gara, like 36 phases, 37 phases?
Yeah, I think, yeah. I think it was...
Was it more? Was it 40? Low 40s?
I think it was 40.
Low 40s? Yeah, Sexton's one was...
If a movie was made about this, if they were to make a movie about this World Cup, you know full well that that would be the last kick of the game and the whistle would go. Like,
who'd play Johnny Wilkinson?
Will Ferrell.
Oh, wow. That would be a turner for the books. I think maybe a long-haired Tom Hardy.
Oh, yeah. I could see it.
On a sad note, I think
I go with Tom Hiddleston as a.
I don't like Tom Hiddleston. I can't think of his name. A Joker guy passed away.
Heath Ledger.
Remember him in The Knight's Tale? That's got like Johnny Wilkinson vibes.
Yeah, that's true.
Steve, I had no idea where you were going with that. What are you talking about?
Oh, the Heath Ledger thing. Yeah, I'm just saying he would have been good to play that role.
Hey, you started with the Joker though.
That's what I'm saying. I don't know. Like, yo, I can't remember. I couldn't remember his name. I'm not going to be like, you know, I picked a role that he's famous for. Westy, get off my back.
No, never.
Never. All right, I think we'll wrap it up, lads. This is short and sweet. We'll do this again with different games. I think we're going to do Japan, South Africa, aren't we?
We're going to do Japan, South Africa.
Yeah, I think Japan, South Africa is next.
Unbelievable game to watch,
yeah. Yeah, we'll do that maybe next week, and we'll do again a review one. I think that's a good one to do. And then if anyone's listening that want to suggest a game that we should watch, you can tweet us at us at master of no oh sorry at none underscore podcast, and we can we'll watch it if we can get it on YouTube. Just want to plug your Twitter, guys. Westy, I know you're probably going to forget the Twitter handle.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't mind. Follow me, don't follow me. It doesn't really matter me.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's what you want to hear.
I'm SAMI underscore SP. Follow me for various giving out about sports, teams that I support, the lack of sports. That's pretty much all I tweet.
And your homophobic views.
What homophobic views?
Oh, yeah, sure. Whatever, Sam. Your Twitter is full of bigotry.
No, it's not.
No, I'm not.
That's me retweeting you.
Yeah, that was it. Sorry. All right, guys, we'll wrap it up. Thanks for joining me, and I'll see you next time.
Chat to you later.
Bye. See you soon.